Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Let's do it.
Jaws Dead feels like that. Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Here we go. At
least feels like it. Hello, everyone. It's Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us.
It is Tuesday today. Time to deep dive into a single topic. That topic today, the tax gap in these United States of America.
The tax gap, of course, is the difference between what may be owed to the federal government and what is actually paid to the federal government. It is, of course, tax season. Turns out the people who have the biggest problem paying their taxes are the richest ones, which is sort of not a surprise. But there is new research this week that suggests that the top 1% of households actually fail to report 20% of their income. That is contributing to a tax gap that is projected to top. Stay with me. I'm pausing for dramatic effect. $7.5 trillion over the next 10 years.
So here to make us smart on the tax gap is Samantha Jacoby. She is a senior tax analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think? Can we fix this tax gap, or is that just too hard a question to start with?
I think we can fix it, and I think we should.
Go on.
Yes. So, how? When? How soon?
So this year would be a great time to start. You mentioned the gap between what taxpayers owe and what they pay voluntarily and on time, and basically that's the estimated amount of tax evasion every year. According to the IRS estimates of the tax gap, the biggest source of that is people underreporting certain kinds of business income, known as pass-through business income, and owners report that on their individual tax returns. And that kind of income overwhelmingly flows to wealthy households. Mm-hmm. So for example, around 70% of partnership income flows to the top 1%. So there's a reason why it's such a big component of the tax gap. That kind of income is just less visible to the IRS. So wage earners, for example, have taxes withheld from every paycheck, and their tax evasion is very small. But pass-through business income is self-reported, so there's no easy way for the IRS to independently verify it.
Wow. What could possibly go wrong?
Right.
Sorry.
I want to, before we get into sort of how this happens and how to fix it, I want to back up a little bit and say we're really talking about a lot of money at a time when we're also talking about raising taxes on the wealthy, potentially putting in a wealth tax. And I wonder, could we accomplish all of the things we need to accomplish in this country if we close the tax gap? Like, it seems to me like we might have enough money.
Yeah, we can definitely get a lot of the way to funding urgent national priorities by basically increasing IRS enforcement and helping to close that tax gap. But the biggest piece of it, right, is the IRS needs the resources to do its job. So it's really important to know that the IRS has been basically targeted for severe budget cuts over the last 10 years. So the biggest way to sort of get at that tax gap is just by giving the IRS the money to enforce the tax code.
Surely, I can't even believe I have to ask this question. Surely Congress realizes that if they made an investment in the Internal Revenue Service, we would get back some multiple of whatever it is we spent.
Yeah. I think there's a greater awareness of that recently. There's a greater understanding driven by lots of research into the problem that robust funding for the IRS and particularly IRS enforcement is really a win-win. There's broad consensus from government scorekeepers and agencies to outside analysts that every additional dollar you spend on IRS enforcement raises multiple dollars of revenue that can fund urgent priorities of the kind that we're talking about. Hmm. And that's all without raising taxes.
Yeah.
Right. Without raising taxes. And that's all without raising taxes. Exactly. I mean, that's where I wonder, this must come down to politics like so many things. Like, is it that every dollar you spend on IRS enforcement equals a few dollars less in the fundraising coffers from wealthy people who don't want to get audited?
Yeah, I mean, I think the IRS is hasn't always been the most popular agency. It's also just really hard once you're kind of in the place the IRS is. Its budget is 20% below where it was in 2010 in inflation adjusted terms. It's really hard to dig out of that hole. So even though the budget has somewhat stabilized since 2018, it's still really hard to kind of fix the problem on a year-by-year basis when you're talking about annual appropriations and it's a fight to get any additional dollar. So I think what's really needed is sort of a comprehensive effort to robustly rebuild the IRS, and that needs to be done kind of on a multi-year basis, not just this year-by-year fight in appropriations.
Of course, this comes as the Internal Revenue Service is being tasked, Freudian slip, not even intended, with giving away money through the American Rescue Plan. And that seems to be a mismatch of its core competencies with, say, the Social Security Administration, whose job is actually to give checks out to the American public.
Yeah, the IRS, you could sort of say, has been asked to do more with less recently. Yeah. All the COVID recovery bills have given the IRS lots of new tasks. It's been taxed, as you said, with getting out stimulus payments and expanded child tax credits and lots of other things. So, the good news is the latest bill did include around $1.8 billion, which is a significant amount of money for the IRS to implement those provisions and upgrade its technology. Good. Yeah, but it's really, I mean, you could sort of say it's a Band-Aid to help the IRS get through the day, but it really needs sort of reconstructive surgery.
Yeah.
How much of, just as a matter of like behavior, how much of the tax gap would you say can be attributed to, avoidance versus evasion? And can you explain the difference? Like, we've certainly created incentive for everybody to try to avoid paying taxes if they can. Right.
Yeah. So that's a really good question. So tax avoidance and evasion are somewhat murky concepts. And tax avoidance can be thought of as sort of clearly legal activities like claiming deductions for business expenses, structuring your activities to take advantage of those kinds of things. Tax evasion, on the other hand, is clearly illegal. You're hiding money from the IRS. You're doing things you really shouldn't be doing. But there's not always a clear line. It's sort of a spectrum. The tax gap is supposed to measure tax evasion, but there are certain activities. It's just not quite clear which side of the line it falls on. And you can sort of think about very wealthy people having the ability to kind of hire sophisticated tax planners to make themselves fall on the right side of that line, or at least appear to.
Well, can we get back to a phrase you mentioned a minute ago that the implication took a little bit to sink in, and that's the idea that there are certain kinds of income that are not necessarily visible to the Internal Revenue Service. Now, I'm going to just show my naivete here, but I thought the Internal Revenue Service knew like every penny that everybody made, and clearly that's not the case. Because they know every penny I make, I'm telling you that.
Yeah, they probably do. But they're
how do we hide that? No, just kidding.
This is not legal advice. I cannot.
No. Consult your own tax professional.
Just a joke. Terrible joke.
That again can sort of be thought of as a spectrum. Different types of income are very visible. Right, I mentioned wages before. People who earn a wage or a salary The IRS knows exactly how much income they have, and the tax that they owe is withheld from every paycheck. And then at the end of the year, the wage earner reconciles what they owe with the IRS. So there's really not very much ability to hide any of that mm-hmm. income. Then you have something like capital gains. If you sell some stock, your broker, your bank will send you a return that tells you how much gain you had. They'll also send that to the IRS, but you still have to put that on your tax return and pay tax on it. Hmm. And then somewhat on the other end, right, is business income that you report on your individual tax returns. The IRS doesn't know if you got a bunch of your business income from cash or even, you know, credit cards or other, they don't get returns for that sort of income. You just have to report it, right? So if you have a significant share of businesses or individuals who own those businesses that are just not reporting their income, it's mm-hmm. really unfair to those businesses that are accurately reporting their income. Yeah.
Also, I'm totally doing it wrong. I'm just saying, that's all.
Well, I mean, I think that's what that does get to kind of the fundamental question about solutions, right? Because you have businesses. I mean, Amazon's Jay Carney at this point is somewhat famous for going on TV and saying, yeah, Amazon pays zero taxes. That's true. Yep. Everything we're doing is legal. And individuals are like, it's totally legal for me to set up a pass through for my business, apparently, and like run stuff through there and then not get taxed. And so what do the fixes look like? In a holistic way, a way that would solve both evasion and avoidance, and maybe mm-hmm. you know, narrow the thin line there.
Yeah, so I think, you know, funding IRS enforcement would allow the IRS to hire these, you know, very sophisticated, highly trained auditors that can audit the companies that and individuals that might be sort of operating in that murky area, and then that has indirect effects of encouraging other people to be compliant with their taxes because they don't want to get audited and they don't want to have to go to court and do all of that. So that's one way. The other, you know, another big way is, you know, there are things that Congress can do to improve or increase the amount of information that the IRS has on those types of income that are sort of less visible. So, for example, there's a former IRS commissioner, Rosati, who has proposed a way to increase visibility of business income by basically requiring banks to report information about a business's inflows and outflows of money. And then the individual who owns that business has to reconcile what's on that return that it got from the bank with its taxes. So basically it improve the ability of the IRS to flag problematic returns and then audit them, which would in turn then have downstream compliance effects.
It sounds like you're saying it's a long list, but it's time to get started.
this year represents a perfect opportunity to get started.
Samantha Jacoby is a senior tax analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, fascinating.
$7.5 trillion.
It doesn't it feel like, I mean, I know I'm being hopelessly naive here, but doesn't it just feel like this should be
so easy.
Easily
it should
agreed
so easy.
Upon?
It
like should this so should easy. Be bipartisan.
It should be
you know?
So easy.
Like, I know that there's this kind of sense that like Republicans vote for tax cuts and Democrats want tax increases. And it sort of feels like everybody could have everything they wanted here, maybe.
Yeah. Just enforce the rules.
Just enforce the rules.
Yep.
This is one of those moments where I'm sure there's a bajillion reasons I'm wrong, and all those reasons come down to no one wants to, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, man. All right.
Anyway,
well,
good talk.
We will we'll move on from the tax code. But if you've got thoughts or comments on what we were talking about, and I'm sure you do because tax day is coming up. Although let's remember it's been pushed on May 17th this year, May 17th for filing and paying at the federal level. Check your state tax bureaus for all y'all's deadlines. Comments come to us in an email. If you have to, voice memo preferred, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Coming back.
It's all I can do not to sing along with our song sometimes. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Time for the news fix. Let's talk some more about money.
Yeah, well, so I've got. I think this is becoming my norm, 1.5. So I was out yesterday, not paying attention to the news. So this actually was in the New York Times of yesterday, but it's completely relevant to government funding and one of the things we're going to talk about real soon, which is Reaganomics and the size of government. The Biden team now, fresh off a $1.9 trillion stimulus plan, is getting ready to drop a $3 trillion plan in new spending for this economy. Infrastructure, tax credits, all kinds of things. And it's really revealing in terms of how Joe Biden's going to govern, right? I'm from the government, I'm here to help you, being the scariest words in the English language, thank you very much, Ronald Reagan, is clearly no longer true for the Democratic Party. And I just, it's a mind shift of significant proportion. And I think everybody should read this piece because there's a lot that's going to be in there. And oh, by the way, we're going to have a fight about tax cuts too. There's going to be a fight about the tax code, just so we're all ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Because they say the plan may be financed in part through tax increases on corporations and the rich. But again, increases?
Right.
What if it's just compliance?
Right.
I'm like obsessed with this.
So if you get
why are we ever talking about tax increases when it's just going to give them more reason to try to avoid it?
This would only take half the money we would get through compliance. This would take less than half. A $3 trillion plan would be less than half the $7.5 trillion. We can get back. So,
like, seriously, sometimes I'm like, am I a baby? Is there something I just fundamentally don't understand here? Collect what you're owed and you don't have to raise taxes. And that would dip. Anyway, yes, fascinating. Yeah. And it is going to be a huge fight, obviously. Yeah. Huge fight. Like, to me, this is the voting rights bills must be the throwdowns about the filibuster.
Yeah, I think the voting rights bill will be. I don't think this one will be. I think you got to pick one. But they're going to pick the voting rights bill, right? For sure they're going to pick the voting rights bill to have that fight on. You bet.
Right. And maybe they have that fight so that they can tee up this one. Yeah. One thing that was suggested yesterday, and I don't know, the New York Times seems to be reporting now that it's going to maybe be like two separate proposals. There was some talk yesterday that they might try to split this up into multiple bills to make it, you know, more palatable than one gigantic argument that would take years and years. But no, it is beyond ambitious. And fascinating.
The era of big government is back, I think you could say. Okay, so that's my one item.
Upon us.
My half item is this, an interview that Ezra Klein did with Bernie Sanders, which gets to, in some pieces, the size of government, but also to a thing we have talked about on this program, which is social media and deplatforming and the former president of the United States. Ezra asked Bernie Sanders about Trump being banned, and Bernie said this, quote, "This is a bad news guy, but if you're asking me, do I feel particularly comfortable that the then president of the United States could not express his views on Twitter? I don't feel particularly comfortable about that because yesterday it was Donald Trump who was banned and tomorrow it could be somebody else who has a very different point of view." All of that as a precursor to this little news item. We are still waiting for the Facebook Oversight Board to come out with its ruling on the 45th president of the United States and whether he should be allowed back on that platform. And I just want to make sure people are paying attention to that because it's going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I believe I have referred to this as the slippery slope.
Yes, you betcha. Absolutely.
Yep.
Oh, I should have done my Bernie impression. Anyway.
Let's not forget the incitement to violence, but still, yes.
Yeah.
Still, yes.
Yeah.
I saw this interesting piece in, we have talked obliquely and explicitly on this show for years and years about essentially the economic cost of discrimination, but two, obviously, the company's roles in increasingly in our democracy to a degree that itself is a slippery slope and we should totally talk about. But what I thought was very interesting is that The New Yorker published a piece a couple days ago, actually, I've been sort of sitting on it, about the high cost of Georgia's restrictive voting bills and pointing out that historically, overly restrictive policies and racist policies in Georgia and in other states have led to business backlash. They talked about, for example, there was Georgia put in an extremely restrictive abortion bill that disproportionately hurt women of color. And it caused, you know, basically the movie industry to threaten to pull out of Georgia. And that was a big part of Stacey Abrams' platform when she ran against Kemp and managed to talk down, you know, some of these high profile projects, get them back into the state. And then the law was eventually struck down. And today, apparently, 18 Fortune 500 companies have operations in Georgia. A lot of those movie filming deals came back. Mm-hmm. And now there is this question about the economic fallout of this voter restriction effort. There have been protests outside of Coca-Cola's corporate headquarters. People have been putting a lot of pressure on Home Depot, which did this weird thing where it sort of appeared to oppose voter suppression and then issued a clarification to the Washington Post to make sure that they didn't necessarily oppose voter suppression. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One imagines that's not going to end well for Home Depot.
Yeah.
But what is so fascinating is that now consumers who lack a voice for various reasons, or who feel consumers, voters.
Yeah.
I mean, how Freudian is it that I just did that? Yeah. That just tells you everything you need to know. Voters who feel that they lack a voice with their politicians, whether because they can't keep up with the corporate money, or there's filibuster, or there's a gerrymandering that means that their votes don't, you know, get counted or aren't evenly distributed, let's say, are turning to companies to make their case for them. It's like this weird new lobbying campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's so uniquely American democracy.
Yeah. You know what else I've noticed in the last couple of days is a lot of companies who paused their political contributions in the wake of January 6th have started mm-hmm. up again, giving money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the other interesting facet of this, right? Is like, don't kid yourself, Americans.
Yeah.
Companies are not your friends.
Right. Companies are like companies.
They may end up, you know, serving your interests in the short term, but understand that this is a very mercenary partnership.
Right. Right.
You're entering into here.
Right. Anyway.
Yeah. It's it's a strange state that we are in in this country. All right. That's it, right? That's it for the news fix.
Yeah.
Let's hear from you guys in the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Yeah, buddy. So we've been talking about jab versus jabbed and my usage thereof. Here comes Kevin in Canada.
Initially, I thought Kai quite rightly took one on the chin for that aberrant usage.
Thanks, Kev.
An hour later, I got my mind changed.
Boom.
In the latest issue of The Economist, the leader section contains the following phrase. The regulator in Britain, where AZ vaccine has been used abundantly, urged people to keep getting jabbed.
Oh, yeah.
Looks like jab being used by Brits as a verb. English is a deliciously malleable language, and word usage often gets legitimized by various means such as, is it out there in the wild, and is it used by an authority? I think this example fits both criteria.
Yeah.
And when it comes to being a stickler for correct grammar, it doesn't get more sticklerish than The Economist.
Sticklerish, that's true.
Sticklerish.
Yeah.
All right, that is amazing.
I feel somewhat vindicated.
I love it. Do we need to do more controversial shows? It seems like our listeners are honing in on these very specific, although, you know, we do love to argue about grammar, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Sean sent us this after we made our usual plea for more voice memos, including those potentially in robot voice.
That was you, for the record.
Oh, dear.
So, use a robot voice? Okay.
No.
Pretty easy. But if you're listening to this, you'll quickly see that what works well, I think, in text does not work nearly as well as voice. And, while converting text to speech is trivial, asterisk recording asterisk it is not, though I did just learn how to make an automator service, as I did not want to add the audio to music. So, why don't you folks just highlight what you want to hear, and tell your computer to convert it to speech? Thanks for listening, Sean.
Oh, fine. Just send us
right?
emails. I get it.
Yeah.
I see what you're getting at here. Also, that was worth it.
Shot
I'm sorry. It was
chaser.
Worth it.
That was pretty good. All right. We will leave you as usual with the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about? Here comes Kevin in Arizona. Same name, different place.
What I thought I knew, but now know I was wrong, is that filling out an NCAA tournament bracket is just harmless fun. I am lucky to be married to a lovely woman, and we have four amazing daughters. We held our own small family bracket contest this week. When the initial posts about the ridiculous women's training setup in San Antonio came out, I got angry. One more glaring example of the barrage of messages to young girls and women that they are less important and less valued than the boys. Then I went to tally up our round one results, and I realized that I had sent the exact same message to my own girls. So why did we fill out just the men's bracket? I was upset with myself, even if this was unintended. What I learned is that inequity is built into many of our systems and traditions, and when we act mindlessly, we can reinforce some sexist, racist, and other harmful ideas. So I'm trying to make good here. This is me. I'm tearing up my men's bracket, and we're going to fill out new ones for the women's tournament. Thanks for all that you do to make us smart. We really appreciate the show, and it's gotten us through a hard year.
There you go. That is talking the talk and walking the walk right there. Good
That's
for him.
That's amazing.
That's cool. That's great.
Yeah. I That's love great. That. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Way to be mindful.
Yeah.
And produce good audio. I mean, I'm just saying that the tear up the bracket, right, that's good stuff.
It was
stuff.
On mic. It wasn't.
Stuff.
There was not too much. It was good. It was good.
Okay. We might be overdoing it on the audio. That is true. It is okay if you want to email us. We will read your email. We're good at talking. Don't forget to send us, though, your answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Keep the emails and the voice memos, robot voice and all. I'm sorry. That was fun. Keep them coming. Make Me Smart at marketplace.org.
That was good. And that's it for today on a Tuesday. We're back tomorrow. What do you want to know? Wednesday, questions, comments, keep them coming. Till then, we're back tomorrow. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner does production stuff for us. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skills.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad with mixing by Liana Squillaci. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Donna Tam, and the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves.
There we
oh,
go.
For such a delightful name to say.
Isn't it great? I really like
Love
it.
Love it.
Yeah. Squillaci. Yeah.
Bum, 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 bum.
You snapping your fingers?
No, I'm just tabbing between open.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I sort of obsessively control tab or alt tab between open tabs on my browser like a weirdo.
Wow.
Just see what's over there. Is there anything new? Anything new in this tab? Anything new over here? This one, this one, this one, this one?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.